This is The Guardian.
Today, the strike on an aid convoy that shocked the world and ignited a debate in the UK over whether it should be arming Israel in this war.
Normally, being a little extra can be a bit much, but when it comes to healthcare, it pays to be extra. And United Healthcare makes it easy with Health Protector Guard fixed indemnity insurance plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they supplement your primary plan, helping you manage out-of-pocket costs without the usual requirements and restrictions like deductibles and enrollment periods. So when it comes to covering your medical bills, you can feel good about being a little extra. Visit uh1.com to find the Health Protector Guard plan for you.
They had told the Israelis that they were there, travelling along a coastal road in Gaza, six aid workers from the UK, Poland, Australia, and a dual US-Canadian citizen, along with their Palestinian driver, trying to deliver food to more than a million people at risk of famine, when an Israeli drone hovering above them fired. Not once, but three times. Each time, the survivors fleeing to another car, driving a little bit further, and being hit again, until there was no one left alive.
Straight to breaking news, an update on that main story.
Those strikes on the team from the aid organisation World Central Kitchen have done what 33,000 Palestinian deaths didn't.
World Central Kitchen have confirmed in the last few minutes that three of their staff killed in that Israeli airstrike in Gaza were British, we'd said.
Shocked the UK's political establishment into just considering halting arms sales to the Israeli army. Israel says the airstrikes on Monday night were an error, a tragedy to be independently investigated.
The strike was not carried out with the intention of harming WCK aid workers. It was a mistake.
What if the killing of those aid workers wasn't a departure from Israeli military policy in Gaza? What if it's just shown the world exactly what that policy really looks like? From The Guardian, I'm Michael Safi. Today in Focus, will a strike on an aid convoy be a turning point in this war? Peter Beaumont, you're a Guardian foreign correspondent, a former Jerusalem correspondent. The founder of World Central Kitchen has said that this was no accident, citing the fact that his team was struck three times over 1.6 kilometres.
Systematically, car by car, they were targeting us in a conflicting zone, in an area controlled by IDF. Them knowing that was our teams moving on that route with two armor, with three cars. And then they hit the third one, and then we saw the consequences of that continuous targeting attack. Seven people dead.
His organization has since suspended their operations in Gaza, where something like half the population are facing catastrophic famine. What did the Israelis say about Monday's strike?
I mean, the Israelis sort of have been saying, oh, it's a mistake, it's a case of mistaken identity, it was tragic, they shouldn't have been targeted. What's quite clear is that someone at some point in the decision-making process had decided that these vehicles were a legitimate target. I mean, they're supposed to be what humanitarians call deconflicted. In other words, they're supposed to be out of bounds for targeting. Now, the Israeli public statements, you know, from the IDF and politicians are sort of slightly undercut by what's been said by anonymous Israeli sort of officers and officials to some of the Israeli media, which is that there had been a thought that an armed individual, an incriminating individual, as the Israelis call it, had been at the warehouse and had entered the car, was traveling in the car, which wasn't the case, and that it had become a target.
Okay, so according to that report, someone in the Israeli army believed there may have been an armed person attached to this convoy. That is not the case, but on that basis, they decided it was justified to strike it, killing everyone in those three cars. Peter, you've covered a lot of wars in Gaza. Explain to me how an army goes about deciding when it can and can't use lethal force.
There's this thing called the rules of engagement, which kind of is a common phrase in military operations that guides who can and can't be targeted. What the rules of engagement say is it essentially tells you what circumstances you can use force, including lethal force. I mean, it also gives a sense of acceptable collateral damage for the value of a target. One of the problems with the Israeli rules of engagement is we know that they have rules of engagement, but we don't actually know what they say absolutely precisely because they're classified.
So those rules of engagement are secret, but they decide when force can be used, how many civilian casualties are considered acceptable. In this conflict, compared to the earlier ones you've reported on, what have you seen change in those rules that the Israelis are following?
One of the things that we can look at for evidence in the way that civilian casualties have changed over the course of, let's call them the major wars in Gaza, 2008, 2009, 2014, and the current war. In the previous two wars, what you can see is that the largest group who are being killed are men. In this conflict, what you see, and even if you take the Hamas accounting with an absolute pinch of salt, that the largest group being killed are women and children. And that suggests that there has been a sort of change in the way in the tolerance of civilian casualties.
Israel's confirmed that it hit the Jabalia refugee camp in northern Gaza. It says it was targeting and killed one of the Hamas leaders responsible for the October 7th attacks. The Hamas-run Gazan Health Ministry says at least 50 people were killed, with hundreds injured.
One of the incidents that gets talked about a lot was a strike that happened on October 31st last year when the Israeli Air Force, it appears, used a number of large bombs, JDAMs, against a Hamas battalion commander in Jabalia in northern Gaza. And there were a huge number of civilian casualties. I mean, well over 100. People who have been following this point to this as being, you know, here is an example of where the IDF decided that a very high number of civilian casualties was acceptable to get one battalion commander. Now, at that kind of level of civilian casualties, you might expect someone trying to make an argument for one of the very senior Hamas commanders like Yahya Sinwar or Mohammed Deif. But I mean, this is a battalion commander.
The director of the Indonesian hospital says that until this moment, over 400 casualties have been received in the hospital between killed and injured.
And so the fact that so many women, so many children have been killed in this war, that indicates to you that there's a different policy from the very top about how many civilian casualties are acceptable for a target.
Yes, I mean, that's what that suggests. And it does feel that in this case, the Israeli attitude is that the gloves are off. You know, what is the other evidence that we can look at that would suggest that there is a different approach to the rules of engagement? Well, we've seen over 200 humanitarians killed during the course of the war, most of them Palestinians. We've seen dozens of journalists killed. We've seen dozens of health workers killed. I mean, these are people who are supposed to be protected under international humanitarian law. It's also clear from what I've heard from people that, you know, this has been developing over time. You know, there have been discussions within the IDF about changing the rules on the ground that have been developing over the last conflict. It's been a trajectory that we've seen unfolding over the course of these conflicts that's taken us to where we are.
Peter, we've been talking here about the rules by which the IDF operates in Gaza, but we've also seen reporting this week in Israeli media and in The Guardian about the fact that the targets that they're choosing to strike under those rules may be chosen with the assistance of artificial intelligence. Explain that to me. What role could AI be playing in this war?
I mean, when you start a war, you generally have a sort of what's called a target matrix or a target set. In other words, if you're in a state of, you know, heightened tension or conflict with somewhere in Gaza, then you have sort of locations in an individual when the conflict begins in earnest that you want to target. But you run out. You run out of targets. Yeah, you essentially run out of targets, and therefore, you know, in this case, the aims of the war are quite grand in terms of kind of completely dismantling Hamas. And therefore, the targeting information that you need to generate, it's time consuming. What seems clear is that AI has been used to build up extremely large target lists of buildings, individuals, where people live. And that has been used to sort of like cast a very, very large net that obviously cannot be cross-examined over Palestinian society.
And outsourcing that life and death question of who is Hamas and who isn't to machines, to AI, you know, it strikes me that on the one hand, it appears that in this war, there's a greater tolerance for civilian casualties than in the past. And on the other, there's this enormous list of targets, perhaps more than 37,000 of them, according to reporting, generated by AI. And so you have this awful combination of many, many targets and a greater willingness to kill civilians to eliminate those targets.
You know, it's chilling technology, but it's not the technology that is sort of setting the parameters for this. I mean, you know, this is a human input, and the civilian combatant casualty tolerance is a human tolerance. It's not the AI tolerance. That is a political and military decision by the Israeli Defense Forces and the Israeli political establishment.
Peter, given what you've been telling us about this loosening of rules of engagement over time, and especially in the past 6 months in this conflict, what does it tell you about what was really involved in the killing of these World Central Kitchen workers?
I mean, one of the things that's come out, and it's sort of in the Israeli reporting, and it's very much been a riposte to the official position, is that the real problem with the WCK fatalities is that Israeli operations in Gaza have essentially become Wild West. People are just doing what they want. And I think that is what has been happening in the context of this kind of higher tolerance for violence and destruction, is that people feel that they can make essentially important and dangerous decisions. Someone somewhere along the line made a decision to strike these vehicles without checking. And that does seem to confirm that notion that there has been a not just a loosening, but also kind of a breakdown of professional military conduct.
In that way, it sounds like that strike on those humanitarian workers was not some aberration. In fact, it reveals what may be happening up and down the Gaza Strip. And if there was an error made, it wasn't in the strike. It was the fact that the people who were struck were foreigners, people whose lives seem to have greater value in the way that this conflict is assessed.
I mean, that's exactly right. I mean, this is not a glitch. This is part of the design of this conflict. And that is the most important thing to take away from this. And the second thing that we need to take away from this is, if it hadn't been six foreign aid workers, if it had been six Palestinians or seven Palestinians, actually, in that convoy, would we be having this conversation? That is also, you know, worrying, because this has been going on throughout this conflict. To be Palestinian, even if you're in theory a protected individual because you're in a civilian role, has no meaning. That is what this has shown us, is that it's dramatized a much, much bigger issue, and that has been the targeting of civilians in general.
Coming up, there's been anger and there's been condemnation of Monday's strikes, but will there be any meaningful action?
It's that time of the year. Your vacation is coming up. You can already hear the beach waves, feel the warm breeze, relax, and think about work. You really, really want it all to work out while you're away. Monday.com gives you and the team that peace of mind. When all work is on one platform and everyone's in sync, things just flow. Wherever you are, tap the banner to go to Monday.com.
Cool fact, a crocodile can't stick out its tongue. Also, you can get health insurance for a month or just under a year in some states. UnitedHealthcare short-term insurance plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage for you. Learn more at uh1.com.
Patrick Wintle, you're The Guardian's diplomatic editor. From Tuesday onwards, we've seen a list of world leaders condemning these strikes on the world's central kitchen workers in far stronger terms than any other strikes before.
We were outraged to learn of an IDF strike that killed a number of civilian humanitarian workers yesterday from the world's central kitchen.
I conveyed to Prime Minister Netanyahu in very clear terms that Australians were outraged.
The Prime Minister told Mr. Netanyahu that he was appalled by the killing of aid workers and demanded a thorough and transparent independent investigation into what happened.
What have people like Rishi Sunak, like David Cameron said? And do you detect a step change in the tone of what they're saying?
I think certainly in the conversation that the Prime Minister Rishi Sunak had with Benjamin Netanyahu on the phone this week, there was a level of anger and distress and a demand for a transparent investigation into what had happened that we haven't seen before. And that was the same with the Foreign Secretary, David Cameron, who has been, over the weeks, becoming increasingly strident in his criticisms of Israel, saying the level of civilian casualties is simply too high and that the promises that he's been given about the delivery of aid have not materialized by the Israelis. So, in a way, Cameron's been in this position for longer, but I think Sunak felt a requirement to say something quite tough to the Israelis. And there's been one report out of a diplomatic correspondent in Israel who said that Sunak very explicitly said to Netanyahu that unless there was a change to the amount of aid that was distributed in Gaza and there was greater safety for those who are distributing that aid, he would have to make a decision about arms export control licenses.
I mean, to stop sending weapons and parts to Israel would be an extraordinary step for the UK. What does the debate over that look like right now inside the UK government?
It has to be said that this has been done twice before. There have been suspensions of arms export licenses before by the UK government, so it wouldn't be an unprecedented act, but it would nevertheless be an extraordinary decision to take only 6 months after Israel had been attacked in the way it had by Hamas. But I think the debate works at two levels. One is there's a technical, dry, legal argument about whether international humanitarian law is being complied with. But I think there's a wider test and a wider discussion, which is much more political. And that's about the perception that the UK would be deserting Israel at a time of its need. And I think there is a huge chasm opening up, not just in Parliament, but I think inside the Conservative Party about what to do. And there's always been very, very strong supporters of Israel within the Conservative Party. And their belief is that if the UK believes Hamas is a security threat to the UK, which it does, then it must be prepared for there to be civilian casualties.
So you're saying that one of the key questions that government lawyers are looking at is international humanitarian law being breached by Israel? And if that's the case, then what's the UK's role in that? Do we have any sense of what those lawyers are telling the government?
Well, we do actually, because at one point, I think in mid-November, there was serious concern in the Foreign Office amongst the lawyers that there were breaches of international humanitarian law. And what the lawyers did, faced by this dilemma about how close they were to deciding there was a breach of IHL, was that they then wrote to the Israeli embassy in London with about eight or nine questions as to how could you respond to both some specific incidents and also how generally lawyers are involved in the targeting process inside the Israeli Defense Force. The Israeli government refused to give any specific responses to those incidents. And on the basis of the reply, the Foreign Office lawyers took the view that if it wasn't possible to know exactly what was in the Israeli government mind when they hit a particular target, one had to assume there was some rationality in the choice of that target. So there was a presumption, in my view anyway, a presumption that the Israeli government was acting lawfully.
Interesting. I want to unpack this. The UK government had concerns over particular attacks, and key to that was the rationale that Israel was using to select those targets. They asked the Israeli embassy, why did you choose these targets? What process did you use? Were lawyers involved? And based on what sound like quite general answers that they got from the Israelis, the Foreign Office concluded, we don't think that international humanitarian law is being breached as of November, as of when these reviews were happening.
Yeah, I mean, to be fair to the lawyers, I'm sure there were other factors taken into account. And I guess the at root of it all is this very difficult decision the Israeli government is having to make in targeting. And you know, if they believe there is a threat posed in some particular target, and that therefore they should go ahead and do so. It's almost the issue is whether the Israeli government was intentionally targeting civilians. As long as they could reasonably show that they believed there was a military target, then that was sufficient for the Foreign Office.
You've said that there are different elements to this. There are legal elements, these legal questions you've described, as well as a political dimension to it. And I'm wondering which you think is more important here. I mean, how much is this question of whether the UK should be sending arms to Israel a question of law, and how much of it is a question of politics?
Well, I thought the very fact that Rishi Sunak sort of used the threat of a suspension of arms export licenses as a bargaining chip with the Israeli government is significant. It might be legitimate to have done that because the intention behind it was to get more aid into Gaza. But instead of there being a kind of cold-blooded, rational assessment of whether there's been a breach, instead he was using the threat of deciding there was a breach. So that to me suggests that there's a blending of politics and the law in all this.
Yeah. I mean, we're talking here in quite abstract legal and political terms, but in reality, when we talk about UK arms sales to Israel, what are we talking about? What is the UK sending? How much of a contribution are they making to the Israeli military?
Well, that's a fair point, because in some senses, it's a moral argument whether you should be complicit in allowing Israel to do what they're doing. But the Foreign Office Minister, Andrew Mitchell, in the final statement he made before the Easter recess, told MPs that UK arms sales to Israel represented something like 0.2% of Israeli arms sales. But there are spare parts that I think we supply for F-16 jets. There's been some allegations that specific UK weapons have been used in specific attacks, but I don't think we're at the center of the sort of arms business to Israel. It's not a huge money spinning business for the UK. It's more about the politics.
This is obviously a huge debate in the UK at the moment. Do you think that the Israelis care, given how small the contribution of UK arms is to their military? How much does all of this matter to them?
I don't think it matters in terms of what Israel might do militarily, but to lose the UK support and sense of that alliance would be, I think, quite devastating. I think probably we are alongside America and Germany, the great ally of Israel. And for us to walk away would add to the sense that is current in parts of Israeli society that Israel risks being ostracized by its own behavior. And that does worry the Israelis. When we look at this more broadly, I don't think the UK government would be eager to suspend arms exports without there being a kind of similar decisions being made in the White House. And on an issue like this, if the UK government was to say there is a breach of IHL by Israel, that puts enormous pressure on Joe Biden and on the White House to come to the same view.
You've said that the key player here is the US, that the UK is going to be reluctant to break away from what the US is doing. Given that, given the importance of Joe Biden in this, where does he sit on this question of whether the US should be sending weapons to Israel? I mean, the majority of Israel's arms come from the US. What's his view on this question?
Well, it's really been striking that for months there's been these stories that Biden is increasingly exasperated, impatient with Netanyahu. But I think now there's come a moment where the disjuncture between his words and the deeds have struck American journalists. There's a number of pieces now appearing in mainstream American newspapers, which are no longer just taking at face value the sense that Biden is upset with how Netanyahu's acting, and they've now moved on to the question, well, what are you going to do about it? And what is happening is now that he's being seen to be weak on Israel, that he's unhappy with what they're doing, but unable or unwilling to do anything about it. So it's causing a problem. And there is still these six or seven swing states, and they are worried about, you only need to lose in some of these states 2-3% of the vote, and you've lost those states, and you've lost all the votes in those states, and you will lose the presidency. So I think there is the political clock is ticking on Biden.
Patrick, a poll published this week of people in the UK showed that a majority of voters, whatever their party allegiance, are now in favour of banning arms and parts sales to Israel. Some 59% of voters believe Israel is violating international humanitarian law. Long term, how much damage do you think this war in Gaza is doing to the UK-Israel relationship? Is this going to be a blip that people don't think about in a year or two? Or is this a realignment that we're watching happen in real time?
I think it partly depends on the outcome. If for some reason, which I currently think is diminishing, Israel is able to crush Hamas and to do so without leading to even more mass casualties, then maybe Israel can extricate itself from this. There's been a letter, for instance, written to the government by as many as 600 lawyers, academics, but including three former Supreme Court judges, saying that the UK does have a duty to suspend arms and that there would be a risk that the UK would be complicit. So, I mean, obviously, we all say that you can get as many legal opinions as the number of lawyers you put in a room, but there is a pretty strong view now that the onus is now upon the UK government to show why it believes there is no breach of international humanitarian law. In terms of the UK, I think the relationship with Israel is very, very strong, and there's a good chance that Benjamin Netanyahu will be unseated in an election some months after this war ends, and many people, not just in the UK government but in the American administration, are utterly fed up with him. So that would be a moment to start again. I don't think the idea that there's going to be a permanent break with Israel is anywhere near where the majority of British politicians are.
Patrick, thank you very much.
Thank you.
That was Patrick Wintour, The Guardian's diplomatic editor. You can find all of his coverage and analysis at theguardian.com. Thank you also to Peter Beaumont, whose analysis about Israel's changing rules of engagement is at our website as well. In response to claims that it uses AI to identify targets for airstrikes, the Israel Defense Forces said in a statement, "The IDF does not carry out strikes when the expected collateral damage from the strike is excessive in relation to the military advantage. In accordance with the rules of international law, the assessment of the proportionality of a strike is conducted by the commanders on the basis of all the information available to them before the strike and naturally not on the basis of its results in hindsight." And that is it for today. This episode was produced by Tom Glasser, Oscar Boyd, and Sammy Kent. Sound design was by Solomon King. The executive producer was Phil Maynard. Have a great weekend. We're back with you on Monday.
This is The Guardian.
Flexibility is great. That's why there's yoga. Flexibility for your insurance coverage is great too. That's why there's United Healthcare Insurance Plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, United Healthcare Insurance Plans offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage for medical, vision, dental, and more. One of these plans may be right for you if you're, say, between jobs, coming off your parents' plan, turning a side hustle into a full hustle, or even missed open enrollment. Want more flexibility? Find out more about United Healthcare Insurance Plans at uh1.com. Want flexibility? Take yoga. Want flexibility with your health insurance? Check out United Healthcare Insurance Plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer flexible, budget-friendly medical, dental, and vision coverage that may be right for you. More at uh1.com.
Hi, this is Craig Robinson from Ways to Win, and support for this podcast comes from Invesco QQQ, the official ETF of the NCAA. Invesco QQQ is proud to sponsor this episode and even prouder to provide access to innovation for the last 25 years. Basketball has had innovations over the years, too. We're seeing the game played in new ways every day. Learn more at Invesco.com/QQQ. Let's rethink possibility. Invesco Distributors, Inc.